This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cheap, crude, lewd, avant-garde home movie versions of Hollywood melodrama. That's the kind of films the Kuchar brothers made in the 50s and 60s in New York City. John Waters once said George and Mike Kuchar influenced him more than anyone. The brothers stopped making films together in 1965. The Museum of the Moving Image in New York City just began a retrospective of George Kuchar's work. The retrospective is called Gossamer Garbage and will include such underground films as Hold Me While I'm Naked, Lust for Ecstasy, and The Devil's Cleavage, as well as Kuchar's recent video journals. The museum catalog essay describes his work as fueled by the creative tension between Hollywood dreams and everyday realities. As an introduction to his work, I'll let George Kuchar describe his 1966 film, Hold Me While I'm Naked.
The story was, well, actually it was supposed to be a different story. I had my friend Donna Kness, and she was going to act with another woman, Gina Zuckerman. And Gina Zuckerman had gotten a divorce from her husband. I changed her name later to Gina Duval, and she was mad at me for doing that. But it was actually supposed to be about a mother and daughter vying for the attentions of the same man. And it was going to be a big kind of torrid potboiler. And actually, it didn't turn out because Donna got sick. And she had an ailment that caused her face to puff up. So I decided to focus it more on my dilemma, not being able to make a picture. Only I changed it around, not the fact that she was ill. And she did appear in the picture. And she didn't look that bad, but you can see her face was swelling a little.
So what was the new storyline?
Well, the new storyline was about my troubles making a picture. And I made it that nobody wanted to be in it because they were asked to take their clothes off. Instead of, the fact that she was ill. So it became more about a dilemma about a filmmaker. And also it was about something else. It was about somebody, a person thinking that everyone else is having a good time and they're not.
Yeah,
sexually.
Well, right. There's a scene, for instance, in which there's a couple in the shower, very sensual, the water's pouring down on them. And,
right.
And they're in the shower with their clothes on, and of course the bodies are kind of coming through their clothes, beautiful bodies, and they're beginning to make passionate love, and they're slowly stripping. And then the camera cuts away to you in the shower, and you're like, you're taking off your socks, and you're, undoing your baggy pants, and you're stepping into the shower and just washing yourself, and finally just banging your head against the wall.
Right.
A real contrast between, like, ordinary life and this kind of imagined, incredible, tarred relationships everybody else is having.
Right. Well, there was a shot of my buttocks supposed to be in the picture, but I framed it too low, I think. Oh, no. Maybe it was in there, but I thought they looked too big because I was shooting in a wide angle and it was aiming down. So I said, yeah, that looks stinko. So I cut it out just when my underpants started to go down.
Oh, I see. When you're stripping
and
to get
then,
into the shot.
Yeah. But, and then I guess I thought, since the main star, had a colorful cloth wrapped around her like a toga, I would wear one also and add a little mystery to the nudity.
Did you always feel that other people were having more fun than you?
I did. In fact, I thought a lot of other people were much more attractive. And I think it's just the fact that they were not me. So it's something that I always thought about. I suffered through.
You still suffer with it?
Well, I go to a gymnasium now. I work out, so if I have to do a nude scene, I don't look that bad. And then when springtime comes, I try and lay in the sun so I have some color.
That's bad for you now.
I know, that's what I hear, but I think it's a lie. I think it's people want you to stay inside and work in an office.
Well, you've lately been doing video diaries.
Right.
And in some of them, you have very everyday things like a phone call or a dinner. But you have this big dramatic music behind it, investing it with a kind of drama that it wouldn't otherwise have.
Right. Well, I always liked music and pictures. And I had friends that didn't like it because they used to go to a lot of foreign pictures. They didn't have so much music. But, I know in opera, you got music running all the way through and no one says, turn the music off, there's too much music. So I always did enjoy music.
And when did you start making diaries?
I made it about 8 years ago. So I think I started 8 years ago with 8mm. So I went back to sort of the size that I started with in movies, because I started in 8mm movies. So I bought myself a Sony 8mm camera, and I still have it, 8 years. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, a lot of filmmakers were looking at me and looking at that thing and thinking it was a cheap plastic toy, and I was wasting my time with this thing. But I liked it. It was like a friend. I took it on vacations, and it stayed by my bed. I made sure it didn't get wet, and it was like a little intelligence.
Did you go to the movies a lot as a kid?
I did. I used to go a great deal with my brother, and we liked the early Roger Corman movies. I had liked them because the people in it were, they were professional, but they wound up in such a lousy project, like Cheap, that it was so interesting to see adults behaving in such a way, you know what I mean, in such an incompetence. So I thought it was sort of very encouraging and not so frightening to grow up, if that's what it was like. So I very much enjoyed that. Also, it took it away from the illusion. You knew that you were watching a picture, and I sort of liked that double thing going on in the movie theater.
What else did you like?
Well, I used to see the dramas, the Douglas Sirk dramas, and I thought those were real professional, like adults working and doing an excellent job. So that was very inspiring, and it had very good music and cinematography.
Oh, and it had these big emotional themes.
Right, very big. And I sort of loved the kind of language, the Hollywood language. Even, it was a German man, he's a German man, but he made such beautiful Hollywood imagery with his crew.
What about war films, monster films, westerns?
Well, war films I used to go to, I never really enjoyed them. There wasn't enough women in them. And I liked them if there was a lot of women in it, and it showed the soldiers, you know, being with their women. And then it showed what the women were doing back in the city, you know, when they were gone. And I used to go to westerns, and I never really cared for them. But it's just something you go to. When I was younger, you know, the westerns were out. And I never really, the rocks and everything had no meaning to me. And it isn't until now, till recently, I went to Arizona and I saw how beautiful and big those rocks are. It's quite a wonderful world. And now I want to see the westerns that I saw in my youth because I realize the rocks are beautiful.
And monster films?
Well, monster films I love so much because they are the most realistic pictures around.
How so?
Because they deal with the true issues of your inner self. And they're able to do that without trying to make it look realistic. They don't have to try and be real because they only look phony anyway. So what they do is they get more at the pictures seem to get more at the core of troubles, inner troubles and, you know, things about life. So I found them very, very mature on a level of, like, being human.
So after getting very involved with the movies you were seeing at the local theaters, what was the home like that you came back to?
Well, when I was here living in New York and in the Bronx, is that you went to work, and of course it was miserable, and they boss you around, and you get on that subway, and it's crowded. The only time the subway is fun is in the morning because everyone's horny. So once in a while, you know, somebody reaches out and grabs you and stuff like that. But in
it's a woman's nightmare. Well, this is what made the subway horrible.
I used to look forward to those moments, you know.
But then, when somebody grabbed you.
But then, you know, those things happen not that often, and so it's mainly just a crush. But then, late in the day, none of that happens. Everybody's so tired. It's just, you know, a train of people coming home, and they're very tired. And then you go home, and you bring home a cake because there's nothing else to come home to. And so, of course, you gain weight and goes on and on like that, and you get old real fast.
What was home like when home was your mother's house?
Well, she was cooking a lot, and then you had to be there on time, and she liked you to eat the food hot. So there was always that tension. You better get to the table right away or there's going to be trouble. And she's a very nice woman, you know. But, of course, she was married, and that had its rough spots. And my dad had a very good porno collection. And he read all kinds of sexy books. So I used to read the literature that he had.
Do you have like an 8mm porno collection?
Well, he did. He was a truck driver. And they had the notorious red reels. They used to circulate it among the men there. And then he would come into the room and say, "You got your 8mm projector? Can I borrow it?" I said, "Okay." But I said, "What do you got?" He said, "I have a movie. And I want to see it." So I got interested. And he would say, "Okay, you can see it after me." So I would play it.
So did his collecting of 8mm pornography help you get a sense of the technology, or did you have your film stuff before he started watching it?
I had my film stuff before, but sometimes I used to re-photograph those movies and put it into some of my stories.
You know,
like a bunch of people were watching like a porno picture. And But I already had interest in movies going on already.
Mm-hmm. So. It seems to me that instead of making your ambition going to Hollywood, your ambition was more to bring some of the stuff of Hollywood drama into the ordinariness of your life.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, I go to Hollywood, but, you know, you need a car in Hollywood. And also, it's a very, like, sex-charged place. And people are under a lot of tension, and that's why there's so much hanky-panky going on. And I can't work very well in a group where there's money at stake, because I know that we're going to lose money. And I'm not very good at meetings, and I like just tackling something. And also, when you work with actors, they want to know exactly what the characterizations are all about and this and that, and I just don't know. Sometimes we start from scratch and we just invent it on the spot. So I think I wouldn't fit in very well. I would get the company into trouble and then just be a pain in the neck.
Uh-huh. But you've enjoyed bringing a touch of Hollywood drama into your day-to-day life?
Oh, yeah, it's true. And then, you know, when you relive it in your head, it is like a drama, because this is your story of your life. And then if you can actually put it on film or make paintings of it, you're actually, you know, sharing it with other people. But since we see movies so much in television, it's probably just, see, I think it's even constructed like that in your head, you know.
My guest is George Kuchar. His underground films of the 60s and 70s and his recent video journals are being shown in a retrospective of his work at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York City. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Independent filmmaker George Kuchar is my guest. You're one of the pioneers of independent films. How did you start making your own? I mean, how did you and your brother first get a camera?
Well, in the early days, my aunt and my mom were on talking terms, barely. And my aunt had a camera. And so she would loan it to us and we'd take pictures. And then when they had a falling out, my aunt and my mom bought us a camera so that we would, you know, wouldn't have to go see her. And so we started on making our pictures. And then when we were showing in the American avant-garde, the underground showcases here that Jonas Mekas was having, and at that time Warhol was beginning to make pictures. That time we saw 16mm pictures and said, oh, that's kind of interesting. Maybe we should get a 16mm camera because we're working out. My brother and I are working. So my brother was going to buy a fountain. It was a fountain that dripped water, and it looked like a science fiction type of thing. And instead of spending the $500 on that, he bought a 16mm camera. And we started making 16mm movies. And then the people who had seen our pictures in 8mm, the other filmmakers thought, like, well, 8mm is something, and they were switching to 8 and were sort of shocked that we had gone into 16.
How did you find your early stars?
Well, they were friends of ours, and we had very few girl friends. So my brother and I and some other friends used to switch roles. We would play the female parts and the male part. And then we had really no backgrounds, and we wanted to make exotic pictures, like at Atlantis or Egyptian things. So we used to go on the roof where it was just black tar walls. And then at the time on television during that period, they used to have avant-garde plays where a whole thing would be played out against a black stage with maybe just a stepladder in there. So we thought, well, that's a kind of style. So maybe people can fill in the background if we have the costumes on. So we used to go up on the roof and take the camera and try to do it fast before my mother came home from work because we borrowed her drapes and her clothing and stuff. And she would catch us up there. It would be a horrible scene. We'd get beatings, and it was considered a shame and a disgrace. Plus, we used to throw dummies off the roof, you know, for when things had to happen, you know, like special effects and stuff. And the neighbors, you know, was wondering what was going on. So in a way, it was kind of considered a shame. And then we thought it was such a shame we burned those early films.
You did?
Yeah, and there's very little left from that real early period.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, it's gone.
Oh. So when did you start actually getting women in your movies so you and your brother didn't have to dress as
well,
women?
Well, we had these tomboy-type girls, and they were very nice, and they liked taking big, long walks, and then we would dress them up. We'd put on... I started, I guess, my makeup career. I became later known as Mr. Dominic in some of my movies. And at that time, there used to be a man going on television, and he had stencils of how you can do your eyebrows. You put a stencil on your face, and you do eyebrows. And I thought that was so interesting, so I got the idea to let's do makeup. And I always thought that was kind of interesting. Before you you know, go in front of the camera, you had the whole process of being redone and made up and stuff like that. So we used to put makeup on them, and then it sort of spread out. And then when we began showing pictures in the 8mm showcase places, we would meet people in the audience who wanted to be in the movies, and, you know, like friends and wives of other filmmakers, and we'd have them in pictures. So it began branching out.
When you started making movies, you were working with your twin brother.
Right.
Did being twins add a little extra drama to your lives?
Well, actually, it's I don't know if you ever saw that picture. It's a horror movie, Basket Case.
Yes.
Well, that's a very good inkling of the psychology between twins. And it's very accurate. And so it has its upside, but it also has its downside. And it's got strange twisted alleys as far as, like, mental thinking.
What are some of those strange twisted alleys?
Well, it's hard to actually go into it right, you know what I mean, on the air here. Well, in other words, there are strange, you don't know if jealousy will come in and suddenly, if maybe you're doing something to cripple the other half of you, you know what I mean, which it would be your brother. You're not sure if you're responsible for maybe crippling them in some way and causing something going wrong. And then you're not sure if you should bring certain people over the house because would the person feel bad, your other half, you know? And it's very similar to that movie, Basket Case.
Did this have anything to do with why you stopped making movies together?
No, not at all, because my brother and I have been living together for 51 years. And we were very much friends. But we also have to not know, we know about each other, but then we have to not know too much.
How did you start getting your films screened?
Well, we used to shoot in like friends' houses, and then the following week they would have a party, and we would bring our film to show what we had made there, and that became our showcase. Then I started to meet these older people, and instead of being very dead kind of old people, they were like 10, 15 years older than me, they were real kind of crazy. This was, I guess, in the 60s. And they sort of were kind of wild and crazy. They were fooling around with one another, and they were thinking kind of different. So I was introduced to them by my star, Donna Caness. We went to high school together. And I saw that, well, gee, these are strange people. We began making movies with them, and then they were in tune more with what was happening, like in the underground movies and in the art world here. And they said, why don't we go and see these pictures here? I want you to see some of these movies. And it was at the Charles Theater where they were playing 16mm underground movies. And then we were asked to show our movies at one of those showcases. And I think it was a loft, Ken Jacobs' loft. And the movies seemed to be a hit. And a lot of the people from that, you know, culture kind of area came. And the movies were asked to come next, the following week. And Jonas Mekas came and wrote about it in his column in the Village Voice. And we began to be something on the regular circuit of the underground movies. And we began meeting these other artists and stuff. And I always thought, you know, to get into a museum and to be, you know, noted like that, you'd have to be dead. And instead, these doors began opening, and you began meeting these artists, and they took you as one of them. But then they, we had other friends, you know, worked in the post office and stuff, and I know the artists used to tell me, one of them did, that, oh, you have friends that work in the post office? He said, those are the real people. So in a way, those artists, they felt like they were like an outsiders or something.
So for, I guess about 23 years, you've been teaching at the San Francisco Art Institute?
Right.
And do you use your students in your cast?
Well, yeah. Sometimes I befriend my students. In fact, I hardly befriend the faculty. I think we repel each other. We, you know, nod, this and that, and we talk, we go to meetings. And it's actually kind of civilized. But I actually make friends with the students. For some reason, I forget the age difference. It doesn't seem to matter. Maybe I seem to be think I'm young again until I just look at myself on the screen, you know. But in school, we have a workshop, and the name of the class, they were thinking of changing all the class names to attract students, so I picked ACDC Psychotronic Teleplays because I was shooting not only in film. I couldn't shoot so much. Our budget was only $1,000 to make a production. And I was putting in too much money of my own to bail out our projects. I would put in $1,000 of my own money every semester. So I decided I would shoot in video, you know, commit the sin and bring the video camera into the film classroom. And we're shooting film, video. They're welcome to bring in their still cameras, also Polaroids, anything that they want. We do drawings. And they alternate as far as they get a chance to do sets, you know, act, maybe direct a scene. You want to write a part here and there. And I oversee the whole production.
Mm-hmm.
I give them the whole idea. And then from there, we jump off and they put in their, you know, feed into the project, their ideas. And then we try to make something that can hit the screen and somebody in the outside world will maybe find a value. And so every semester we turn out a production. And I usually screen it with some of my own stuff.
One last question.
Yeah.
The music, the big dramatic music that you
right.
use in your films, do you get them from recording?
Yeah, it's from records. And I had a big collection of records, and occasionally I go to use record stores and pick them up. Sometimes they're $2.50 or sometimes $3, a whole bunch of things.
And ever get sued?
No, never. You know, most of my stuff, see, I do everything wrong. Everything that I do is wrong, because I found if you do it right, it costs too much money. And so, you know, it's all wrong. People never sign releases in the picture, and there's never any kind of thing like that. In fact, they're, you know, probably completely backward, and it's the, sort of the way I work. Eventually, they fall apart, even the movies that spliced wrong. So I found that the only way I can do it is to do it wrong.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
All right. Well,
thanks.
Good luck, and thanks for the interest in my work.
George Kuchar's film retrospective, Gossamer Garbage, continues at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York City through September 5th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.